Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was a week of not over yets. A ceasefire in Lebanon early Monday with a Hezbollah claim of victory and a Mideast conflict bitterly unresolved. A loud ruling at week's end from a federal judge saying there are no kings in America and President Bush's warrantless wiretapping is flatly unconstitutional. A ruling the administration instantly vowed to appeal. There was pension legislation that may not save your pension, an immigrant claiming sanctuary who may not be saved, and a planet named Pluto that may or may not still be a planet. We've got a great panel this week to help us make sense of it all. Joining us from Philadelphia is Trudy Rubin, foreign affairs columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Trudy, thanks for being here.
Pleasure to be here.
From Dallas, Texas, we're joined by William McKenzie, editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Bill, good to have you.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be here.
And as always, with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom, Trudy, and Bill.
Trudy, take us in. There's a lot to look at this week. What's at the top of your list?
Well, I believe the Lebanon story is, and in the background, actually, the much more important Iraq story, which was pushed out of the headlines by Lebanon. But in Lebanon, I think you saw a situation where Israel, egged on by the Bush administration, pursued a strategy that was bound to fail. Israel had a right to respond to a Hezbollah attack across a recognized border, but they tried conventional military means, shock and awe bombing, and that just doesn't work when you are dealing with a guerrilla movement that is deeply rooted in society. And what I can't figure out is why the U.S. encouraged a strategy like that when we have found out that it didn't work in Iraq.
Your column is headlined Shock and Awful. How deep is the trouble that Israel's in now that the U.S. is in this whole region?
I think the trouble is truly deep, and the real heart of it can be seen in Iraq, where this week statistics came out that showed that insurgent attacks are on the increase, both against U.S. troops and against Iraqi civilians. The sectarian war, low-grade civil war, is intensifying, and we don't have a strategy. And I'm not sure there is a strategy, because continuing what we are doing is probably only going to keep the civil war under control. But if we pull out, I think the civil war will explode. Iraq will split up. Iran will control part of it. Salafi insurgents, hardcore Saddamists will control another part, and we will have the region in turmoil. And I think that the Lebanon brief war showed that we don't have a strategy or a new way of coping with irregular warfare like this. We need a new doctrine fast.
Mm-hmm. Bill McKenzie, you're there with a clear eye in Dallas. How does this week's news look from Bush country?
Well, it's hard to quarrel with what Trudy has selected. Certainly that the Lebanon story, the larger Mideast question is big. Immigration remains a big issue here. We had the House had hearings on immigration issues in El Paso and in Houston this week. Interesting enough, some mayors of the big cities of Texas kind of had their own counter hearings, and they came out to present information that would be different from what the House was hoping to hear in both El Paso and Houston.
Different in what direction, Bill?
Well, and more towards the reason why we need comprehensive reform and not just try to do something to only secure the borders. I went recently to one of these hearings that happened to be in Dallas, and it was interesting. There were five panelists. Three of them were from business. Two of the business people at the end of their testimony said, and by the way, we need a comprehensive solution, which is code for saying, yes, we need to secure the borders. We also need to have a guest worker program, and we need to have some sort of earned pathway to citizenship.
Bill, you've written about how President Bush needs to pick up the pace if he wants to leave an imprint beyond the trouble in Iraq. I mean, up in Chicago this week, we've all heard about Elvira Arellano, who took sanctuary in a church, illegal immigrant, but saying, I'm not going home. I mean, there's a mess here. What's the attitude coming out of Crawford? President Bush not there, but what's the tempo you're feeling?
Well, I think actually I was encouraged they left Crawford early because I wrote in this column, I think they need to a giddy up in their step. Mm-hmm. He has only 2 years left, as we know, and really less than that. And here I'm talking about the domestic front. He has less than 2 years, probably only 18 months, to get something done on immigration, which is looking more problematic, to get something done on a swing at both the tax code and entitlements, and something to get done on renewing No Child Left Behind, which is going to come up next year. And there's another education issue that's pending before we even get to that. So I was glad they left and to try to gin up their domestic agenda and to get some forward progress, perhaps even this fall.
Jack Beatty, what do you see President Bush, maybe with a giddy up in his step, getting out of Crawford and back to work, Bill McKenzie has urged him in Washington, sitting down there on the foreign policy front with some unusual guests in his realm?
He was. You know, David Letterman joked this week. He said, according to reports, Fidel Castro was alert and being briefed. And I'm thinking, why didn't we get a president like that? But in fact, you know, he was alert and being briefed this week. And much to his credit, for 90 minutes, which for a president is an eternity, and with his war cabinet at the Pentagon on a Monday lunch.
That means Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld with him?
That's right. Mm-hmm. He listened to critics of the war, critics of the conduct of the war, tell him some harsh news. He listened to experts talking about the religious and ethnic issues there. He asked questions about them. You know, the president is often said, well, he doesn't listen to anyone. This is now the second time he's had one of these panels. Lyndon Johnson couldn't bring himself to talk to anybody. In fact, when Frank Church once quoted Walter Lippmann and said, Walter Lippmann is criticizing you, Johnson said to Church, Frank, the next time you want a dam, have Walter Lippmann build it. And so Bush is listening to people. He's getting, according to General McCaffrey, who's been a fierce critic of Rumsfeld, he's listening to new ideas. They're listening to the reality. Now, whether this will mean anything, whether this will change anything, we don't know. But he did raise issues there in his questions about, you know, why isn't the government more grateful to us? I think he saw in the...
That is the Iraqi government. The Iraqi and people, government. Why are they demonstrating? Why are they stomping on U.S. flags when we've done all this for them?
Exactly. And I think it's beginning to dawn on them that we have put an Iran-friendly government in there. And you could almost see the beginnings, I think. We heard it on our program earlier this week, people talking about a sort of stay the course if. We'll stay the course if this government cracks down, turns on the Shia.
On the militias, militia. Turns them off, yeah. do A, yeah. B, and C. So Cindy Sheehan in Crawford, the president out. Trudy, do you see a kind of changing? Is the weather vane shifting on this president? Is he looking to a new way or a different tempo?
I think this president will keep troops in Iraq because there's no good alternative in the sense that it's not that things will get better, but if he starts pulling them down, things will get so much worse before the next presidential election that I think there'll be a landslide. So there might be a strategy of blame the Iraqis. Oh, the Iraqis, we did so much for them and they didn't deliver. And I think you can see that strategy coming to the fore already in terms of public relations and spin. But the problem is that the system is broken there as a result of our coming in, and we weren't prepared to fix it or to deal with the broken system. We thought it would be easy. Or as former Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz told me in November 2002, he would be astonished if there were instability after a war. So I think this administration is very stuck. And in the meantime, the military is very angry. The army is terribly underfunded and overstretched. And I think they're stuck in a mess. And I don't think it's going to get better.
Bill McKenzie, what do you say?
Well, I was struck by one of the people who was in the briefings there at the Pentagon was Vali Nasser, who is the Iranian-born American scholar. And I'd like to hear maybe what Trudy has to say about him, too. But he's the one who was recently in The Wall Street Journal, elsewhere, has been arguing a longer-term strategy here and a new strategy in that we engage Iran as we try to engage the larger Shiite movement. I looked at some statistics yesterday, and I think this is correct, that 70% of the Persian Gulf region, people living in the Persian Gulf consider themselves Shia, 50% from Lebanon to Pakistan. And we have a couple options. Either if the situation is going to continue to get worse, well, we're going to have the military option, or we try to get ahead of this Shiite movement and try to nudge it and move it in a direction perhaps we could go.
You want the sound of this week in our ear? It began all the way back last Sunday with Mike Wallace of CBS sitting down years after he did it with the Ayatollah in Iran, this time with Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He, of course, sent a letter to President Bush some months ago saying, "Let's talk." The White House dismissed it. Here, Mike Wallace asks Ahmadinejad what response he was looking for when he reached out to Washington.
What did you expect to hear back from President Bush?
I was expecting Mr. Bush to give up, or I should say, to change his behavior. I was hoping to open a new window for the gentleman. One can certainly look on the world from other perspectives. You can love the people. You can love all people. You can talk with the people of the Middle East using another language, other words, instead of blind support for an imposed regime. They can establish a more appropriate relationship with the people of the region.
The president of Iran, Ahmadinejad, talking with Mike Wallace of 60 Minutes there. Trudy Rubin, Bill McKenzie, Jack, let's just step back and look at this for a moment. I mean, there was a very comfortable president of Iraq. And Mike Wallace, God bless him, he went out and got the interview, but he ended up seeming a little overmatched here. But he got it. He brought it home, and he showed us the face of a leader who looked absolutely confident that history seemed to be kind of going his way. I mean, Trudy, are we, despite all of our muscle in this region right now, 130,000-plus troops, is the United States looking impotent out here?
Yes. I think this interview captured a lot, although I felt that Mike Wallace, to a certain extent, blew it, and not because of tough questioning, but because of inadequate questioning. But
he's 88 years old. I mean, give him a break.
You got to give him a break.
And he got there, and he got the man to talk.
That's true. Ahmadinejad, I was in Iran the last 2 weeks in May. And what was fascinating was that there was a drumbeat. Everyone was on message. I saw very senior officials. Mm-hmm. And the drumbeat was, you need us more than we need you. You need to talk to us if you want stability in Iran, I mean, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Lebanon, and in Syria. They were feeling very confident, but they were sending out the message over and over again, you need to talk to us. And that said to me that even though they were cocky and even though they felt that we were weak because of Iraq, where they have been strengthened immeasurably because their allies are in power, that they wanted something, that there was a possibility of some kind of compromise because they need economic development and they can't get it when there are sanctions on. Now, it is true that we changed policy and opened up a little window of possibility to talk to them, but it was not seriously pursued because we have a double policy. We want regime change, and yet we say we're open to talking. You can't have both at the same time. And so as a result, I think what happens is Iran keeps getting strengthened more and more and cockier by what happened in Lebanon, by the deteriorating situation in Iraq. And the cockier they get, the more I'm afraid that they will overreach and that they will no longer even be interested in dialogue.
Bill McKenzie, give us a kind of a chemistry or gut check down there in Texas. I mean, getting cocky in Tehran, Trudy says. We've got a president who says strutting isn't strutting. It's just the way Texans walk. Shock and awful is how this kind of macho thing has turned out. Trudy is saying
let's write it all off quite yet.
How's he handling this?
Let me first say, I've watched this guy for a long time.
Yeah.
And I'm going to counter the notion that he only hears what he wants to hear. I think they could have done a much better job anticipating and planning this war in 02? Yes, you bet. Absolutely. I still don't know whether I think it was the right choice or not to go in there. Mm-hmm. But we're there. I think we've got to stick it out. But I've watched him in lots of settings. And I've heard him, I think somebody used the term smackdown a little while. I've heard him be challenged. I've heard him hear lots of different points of views. And he is a surprising listener. And I've seen this going back to 1994 in lots of different kinds of settings, that he hears lots of different, more voices than meets the eye. It isn't just like he picks up one paper and says, okay, this is what we're going. That's not it. But I go back to what, again, this Vali Nasr option that I was throwing out. And I'd be curious what Trudy is saying, because the situation is bleak. But I was talking to Charles Herman yesterday, who's down at the Bush School of Government at A&M, used to be on the National Security Council, and he was pointing out something Trudy was talking about, that, look, Iran has some refinery problems.
They need some help. Oil refining for gasoline.
Right,
yeah.
But if you want to get
can
back
we,
to
well, hang on.
Sure. Yes, sir.
Can we – are there some chits we can play? We don't need to negotiate with them, in my book, over this enriched uranium, but can we say, okay, you want to deal with us, guys? All right, here we go. Here's what we can offer you, and we can offer it through some of their moderates. So their moderates can turn around and then go to the hardliners and say, okay, if you deal with these guys, this is how they're going to help us with the refinery, as one example.
Trudy, will they go from muscle to nuance, from shock and awe to dealing, deals?
Right. First of all, I highly recommend Vali Nash's book, which is called The Shia Revival, which I just read over my summer vacation. But the point that he is trying to make, and I presume he sort of tried to make it to the president, of dealing with Shiites, I don't think and that means in Vali Nash's book also dealing with Iran. I don't see any signs that the administration is really ready for that in a serious fashion.
But my question is, would it work if it did, if they offered
that? Let me say this. There is absolutely no guarantee. The so-called moderates in Iran are not in power now. It's hardliner and harderliner. But the interesting thing to me when I was there in May was that the people around the real power center, which is Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme religious leader, those people in the National Security Council, they were making fun of Ahmadinejad. They were sort of sneering at him. They said, we make foreign policy. He was not the one who had the idea to talk to the Americans. The letter was falling on policy from on high. And I think there was an interest in talking. But what they said was, you need to pay us. And what is the payment? They think they helped us in Afghanistan and we gave them nothing. What they want is recognition of Iran as the strongest power in the region. And I said, all right, but do you understand what America needs? It needs something on the nuclear issue. You can't just build a bomb. And it needs something on Israel. You can't talk about destroying. Mm-hmm. You can feel some give, although they don't say it outright, but people around them say it. On the Israel issue, I think they're pretty hard line, but perhaps some people say they would give. We won't know unless we have a broad dialogue with them. And yet, if you read Cy Hirsch in The New Yorker, and not just read him, but talk to people in the administration,
they're talking
there are
about
still
the Israel
those who
going
want
into
bomb,
Lebanon as a test run for going into Iran.
There are those who want to bomb Tehran. There is still the thought of regime change. Well, you can't explore the possibility of Iran perhaps being rational and dealing, if you want regime change.
And now we've got magazine covers around the world showing, Hezbollah victory. Agree or not, that's a lot of the PR out there. We've got a lot to look at. I want to get our callers in on this subject. Mahmoud is calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Mahmoud, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I just wanted to ask a question and make a quick comment.
Yeah.
First of all, in order to become a member of the Hezbollah and join the Iranian government, the conservatives and the so-called conservatives and the liberals, so-called, their difference is how many inches a woman can show hair. On the fundamentals of death to America and death to Israel.
The
question that I have is, now humiliated and checkmated, we're going to go on our knees towards Iran. the saying Khomeini said that God will make sure America cannot do a damn thing. And they will say, look, here they are on their knees, and we'll go there humiliated and say, oh, what can we do to be your friends?
So you talking know? Won't
they're
work?
Gonna, they're going to tell us, what part of Death to America didn't you guys hear in the last 30 years?
Oh, boy, Mahmoud, let us pick that up. Jack Beatty, on our knees to Tehran, can you see it? And what message do you expect in response, Jack?
I can't see it. I can't see it at all. Earlier this year, the Pentagon did a war game or a scenario about what would happen if we attacked Iran, and I hope that that is getting through to, especially to Dick Cheney. I mean, I heard a report on that, and basically they said that they would light up the Persian Gulf, that they would blow, they could lob missiles into the oil fields in Kuwait and in the Trucial States, that they would, you know, I mean, on and on and on, and $100 a barrel oil overnight. There just can't be a military solution to this, and therefore they have to talk. And, you know, even some Israelis, former national security advisor to prime minister, talking in the New Republic about even Israel prompting the U.S. or with the U.S. going to Iran and testing them and said, look, what can we do here? There are a lot of things on the board. You want to be able to go on with your nuclear power. You want to be able to get a security guarantee from the United States. Mm. We want things. And, of course, the total racism of the government is a big stumbling block. I mean, Ahmadinejad talking about loving people in the Middle East when he basically wants every Israeli to cease to exist. I mean, that's really right.
I want to get to immigration, but wrap it up for us, Trudy. What do you see there?
Can I just wrap it up and say, I think Mahmoud is right that you cannot crawl. And that's why I think that at this moment when Iran is overconfident because of what just happened in Lebanon, which strengthened their hand and was a defeat for the United States and Israel, not a total defeat, but it just perception of defeat. I think it's important to push for economic sanctions if Iran will not give at all on the nuclear issue, because there has to be a combination of carrot and stick. But the message has to be clear. Shift in policy, we will have a broad dialogue. No regime change. No shift in policy, we will go for sanctions.
Shift in policy, but I mean, I'm feeling something like a shift in power here. Who's telling whom what? Bill McKenzie raises immigration. He's been down at El Paso looking at it. We've got callers who want to talk about it. Carl's calling from Franklin, Connecticut. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you today?
We're well. What do you think about on the immigration front, Carl?
Well, I think we need to take a lead from our counterparts. We keep talking about a guest worker visa. We have one. It's a legal right to come into the country and a work visa that can be established. It's been here for hundreds of years. It works fine. I got friends from all over the world that use it. What we need to do is take leads. I know that if you went to Europe and you wanted to go work, if you went there as a visitor and started looking for a job, the company that would even interview you would be fined substantially just for looking while you're on vacation, and you'd be deported immediately. And if you're caught working there and you don't have a visa, it's a $10,000 fine, and you're deported at the cost of your country, wherever you came from.
But Carl, the issue then is, so what do? Do we open up with a lot more of these visas for workers and clamp down at the same time? Is that what you're saying or not?
I don't think we have a need to actually open up. Unemployment is 5% in our country, and it's said that 5% of our working population is made up by illegal immigrants.
So just crack down.
And it balances out.
Yeah, Bill McKenzie, what you were down in El Paso, you heard, I think, the CEO of Dunkin' Donuts talking down there saying, what, lighten up here. In Dallas,
right,
excuse me.
That was in Dallas, right. Well, I would go back to the caller and say, look, you know, there are 400,000 people who are coming across our border illegally each year, most from Mexico and Central America. And you know, I've been down to that border. There is no way you can fully secure that border. It is too big. You can do a lot more, and the Senate bill does it. It puts a lot more agents down there, puts a lot more detention beds, it puts a lot more aircraft down there. But to the caller's point, we don't have enough visas to accommodate the demand that we get each year. And so what I think the Senate has done wisely is to say, okay, we're going to expand the number of visas. The Senate doesn't come close to the 400,000, but it gives you more visas. So we have a system that could set up to take the illegal flow and try to and direct it into a more legal flow.
And now there's a proposal, but in the meantime, you've got Little Hazleton, Pennsylvania, Jack, stepping up with its own ordinances, its own Illegal Immigration Relief Act. While the president hasn't got one through, Hazleton does, but it is tough. Sets English as the city's official language, calls for a $1,000 fine for landlords who rent to illegal immigrants, allows a 5-year suspension of licenses for businesses that employ illegal immigrants. It's already being challenged in the courts, but Jack, there's little Hazleton picking it up, saying, okay, here's what we're going to do, and it's tough.
Yes, we've had similar things up here in New Hampshire, small towns along the border. And, you know, Pennsylvania is one of those states, according to a Census Bureau report earlier this week, that's been getting, a large percentage of illegal immigrants from Mexico, way up north in Pennsylvania. And, you know, this issue, I mean, Rick Santorum in Pennsylvania, the senator running for re-election, has been in trouble all year, but he's now closed the gap with Robert Casey, the state treasurer, 48-42. And one reason is he's been campaigning against the president's bill. He's been campaigning, you know, essentially for the House tougher version, the border security version, and making traction with it. Other Republicans have, too. And I think this makes it very difficult for the president to get the two houses together here and say, let's do a deal, because this is actually working. Being against his bill is actually working for people in his own party.
Bill, what about it? It's kind of a problem inside the GOP. Can it settle this?
There's a compromise that is kind of emerging to keep your eyes on. Mm-hmm. It's sponsored by Mike Pence of Indiana and Kay Hutchinson, senator from Texas. And it basically would say, okay, you have to spend the next couple of years securing the border. And the government would have to – I think it's the Homeland Security Department – say, okay, we've certified the border has all these things that we want down there. It's now more secure. Then you would get a guest worker program where folks could come here for up to 17 years through a series of steps. And after that period of time, they could earn citizenship. And let me throw in one more wrinkle. Before they could get the guest worker, every illegal immigrant in the country would have to go back to Ellis Island centers that would be up and down for more or less the Texas border, get this thing processed and come back kind of quickly back to their job. The point is there's a compromise that is kind of emerging and shifting. I don't think it is all about border security versus this red herring of amnesty. I think there's a lot of there are people in the middle who perhaps can try to work something out. And that's what I hope will happen between now and December.
Is it going to be, let's think about between now and November. Is it going to crunch the GOP at the polls? Is that trouble for the Republicans then if they don't settle it before then?
You know, there's probably enough in the Republican base that will be glad that nothing has happened. However, over the long term, if you look at the numbers and the Hispanic votes coming in, George Bush picked up Spanish-speaking immigrants. He cut in half the number of Spanish-speaking immigrant votes that Democrats got back under Bill Clinton.
Trudy Rubin, foreign affairs columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, is with us. William McKenzie, editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Jack Beatty's here. What really mattered for you in this week's news? Of course, we had the ruling, the first ruling, judicial assessment of the Bush administration's position in defense of its warrantless wiretapping program. This was Judge Anna Diggs Taylor in the U.S. District Court in Detroit. Whoa, she went after it hard, said there are no hereditary kings in America and no powers not created by the Constitution, she wrote. Alberto Gonzalez, Attorney General, came right back and said, we're going to appeal this. We disagree with this ruling.
We have appealed the decision, and there is a stay in place, and so we will continue to utilize the program to ensure that America is safer.
Jack Beatty, clash of titans set up here. We've got a federal judge saying no, no, and instantly the Bush administration saying, oh, yes, we will. At least we'll try.
Yes, and she's saying no on all fronts, violative of the First Amendment right of free speech, violative of the Fourth Amendment rights against searches, illegal searches and seizures, violative of the separation of powers doctrine, and finally, illegal, just to throw that in. You know, it's a very plainly written, strongly written opinion. I read it this morning, and it bristles with all the great cases and all the lines about American liberty in time of war. The sentence from Ex parte Milligan, the Civil War case, "The Constitution of the United States is a law for rulers and people, equally in war and peace. And she ends this opinion. The last words of the opinion are Justice Warren's from a case of 1967. Implicit in the term national defense is the notion of defending those values and ideas which set the nation apart. It would indeed be ironic if, in the name of national defense, we would sanction the subversion of those liberties which makes the defense of the nation worthwhile. An eloquent end to this very strong opinion.
Trudy Rubin, and here it comes in the same week that we're still taking on board the big MI5 arrests in London. Of course, the UK's internal security has far more latitude than American FBI, let's say, does. And Alberto Gonzalez saying, let's study MI5, which suggests even more security measures taken here that might get in trouble with our Constitution. Where do you see the balance of the country on this?
I think the saddest thing about trying the way that this balance is being sought out is that effectively the administration isn't seeking it. These are issues on which there really needs to be a national dialogue. I think that most Americans understand that in times like these, with potential attacks like just almost may have happened on these airliners, one needs to re-examine whether some civil liberties might have to be curbed according to law. The sad thing is that the president has claimed these rights in a very controversial way as being inherent as commander-in-chief and also as coming from a law which Congress passed, which many of those who voted for it say they never intended to cover many of the things that he says it covers, like warrantless wiretaps. So instead of having a discussion about this, which could happen and you could have a national consensus, we have this divided bitterly by politics in which anyone who questions, even as this eloquent judge has done, is basically overtly or implicitly called traitorous. And I think that's the saddest part of this, because I think you could find compromises, certainly in the case of warrantless wiretapping, with expanding the powers of the FISA courts. I mean, there's all kinds of technical things that could be done. And the president isn't looking for this, and therefore, on both sides, you have it treated as a totally partisan issue.
Bill McKenzie, do you see some cracks in that? Here we've got the judge, Anna Diggs Taylor, a first black woman to serve on the Detroit Federal Trial Court, 73 years old, worked in the civil rights movement, supported Jimmy Carter's presidential campaign, appointed by him to the bench in 1979. And you've got Republicans coming out and saying, hey, this is a liberal judge with an agenda. I'm reading here the dean of the University of Michigan Law School saying her reputation is for being a real by-the-books judge within the Republican Party and across the lines. How do you see the politics of this, Bill?
Well, you know, there is a libertarian strain within the Republican Party that I think would be kind of troubled also by what the administration is doing in with these wiretaps. So I think, you know, there are Republicans who are probably going to privately cheer on the judge. They may not use the same language as the judge, but they are concerned about how far the administration has gone with this. And for the life of me, I still don't understand why the White House didn't use the FISA courts that Trudy referred to, which were set up in this 1978 law. There was a mechanism that they could go get some of these wiretaps. And I think what is what hits me when I read this story and read the story about the airports, I agree with Trudy. I think people are willing to do some compromise, but I think they also want to know that whatever we're trying to do that's different, it's targeted, and that we aren't just having a broad sweep to look at every possible nook and cranny, that we're really going after targeted areas to catch terrorists.
Let's get some confidence on that front if we can. Dylan's calling from Burlington, Vermont. Hi, Dylan. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning.
What do you think, Dylan? What do you see?
Well, I was going to talk about the House and the Senate. I think the Republicans lose one or the other.
In November, you see one of them going down. Why?
One of them going down. Basically because the economic message that the Republicans have brought to this country has failed. You know, we're in debt. We have a winless war. We're in debt. And it's not falling down to the middle and working class. You know, the money's not there. Bottom line. It's not about immigration. It's not about these terrorists. It's about the economy.
And the money that
we can protect ourselves against the terrorists and keep our civil liberties.
Yeah, yeah. And what's in the pocket and what's not? Let us pick it up. Trudy, let me come first to you. I mean, the Democrats this week lifting the anti-Walmart flag. That, you know, here's the boot of oppression. And then Walmart having its trouble with Andy Young, who, the civil rights leader, you know, basically, I don't know, fired or quit because he went after, you know, Jewish, Arab, and Korean shop owners for ripping off black communities after he was hired to sort of burnish Walmart's image. But what do you think of the economic attack here?
Well, I think that the issues that the Walmart case brings up, issues of health insurance, of benefits, are issues that resonate with middle class because benefits, including health insurance, are shrinking everywhere. And I think now that the housing boom is cooling off, and probably in the next couple of years that will have major repercussions, and interest rates are iffy. We don't know where they're going to go, but they may go up again in the future. These economic issues are hitting home. I think there was a sort of false boom fueled by borrowing on people's homes, which now may come back to haunt them. And so economic issues, I do believe, will be crucial. And I think the Walmart case does summarize them, and that it's very telling that the Democrats feel confident in referring to it.
Bill McKenzie, values this time at the polls as the swing issue, or is the economy just too big to get around? Does it help the Dems to go after Walmart?
I disagree with Trudy and the caller. Mm-hmm. I don't think the economy is really the issue in here. We have, you know, what, nearly a full employment economy. The GDP has been quarterly growth has been pretty good. We've had consecutive quarters of growth. The deficit is down to $260 billion. So I don't think that is the pitiful issue. I think the Republicans are up against it because I think a lot of people are mad at Bush over the issues we're talking about mm-hmm. Iraq, about our standing in the world, and they're just kind of fed up and they're frustrated. And I think that is what they would slap away at. I don't think it's the economy.
Jack, look at the economy for us. How strong? Is this kryptonite for the president, or is he riding along just fine? Thank you.
I don't think he's riding along. Thank you. I mean, the aggregate numbers may be good, as Bill says, but the what's happening to family incomes isn't. What with inflation, basically incomes are going down, and that has historically predicted defeat for the incumbent party. Now, they have to lose to somebody. And to me, what leapt out in the news recently was that a poll of Democrats found that 42% couldn't say what their party stood for. I dare say 89% of Republicans could say what their party stands for. And that problem of definition continues, it seems to me, to bedevil the Democratic Party. And I think we saw it on display in the Lieberman, the night that Ned Lamont won. There he was on stage taking the congratulations and surrounded by Jesse Jackson. Well, he's an icon. But Al Sharpton, what was he doing there? And for many people, having that clown and demagogue there and not having the Democrats be able to say to him, go away, that's one of the things that I think really gets the median voter about the Democratic Party. They can't stand up to people like him.
Jack, and speaking of polls, Jolt and Joe Lieberman back up in the polls after that primary loss. Have you got those numbers there?
52 in one poll.
Double-digit lead over both his November opponents now
right.
after the
that's
primary,
right.
both Ned Lamont and the Republican Schlesinger.
And he was being counted out. People, Cokie Roberts on this network said, oh, he'll have to withdraw now. Well, he's not going to. And I think that Ned Lamont has given him an issue by the people he surrounded himself with and by his really kind of inconsequent position on foreign policy. Basically, he says, we have to leave Iraq, but he doesn't fill that out. And I saw the debate he had with Lieberman, and it wasn't pretty. Lieberman clearly has mastery of all the issues. It's going to be tough, I think, for Lamont.
Trudy, here we've got the director of the Quinnipiac poll, which has followed us closely, saying Senator Lieberman's support among Republicans is nothing short of amazing. It more than offsets what he's lost among Democrats as long as he maintains this kind of support among Republicans while holding a significant number of Democratic voters. The veteran senator will be hard to beat. Last week down, this week up, Trudy.
I certainly think the Republican candidate is, you know, totally unimpressive in Connecticut. So therefore, I think a lot of the discussion is what percentage of the Republican vote does Joe Lieberman need to win? I think given a lot of worry over Israel's position after this unsuccessful campaign against Hezbollah, Jewish voters will rally strongly to Lieberman. And so, yeah, I think it's possible that he will win. I think that there is a great difficulty in articulating the pull-out now position on Iraq. Now, granted, there's a large body of the public and of Democrats that that advocate it. But when it comes down to a debate, the problem is that the aftermath is awful, even though you can't show that staying in is going to improve the situation. It's like fingers in the dike. So it's hard to advocate a case for pulling the fingers out of the dike when everyone knows that Niagara Falls will follow. And it's not a good issue, I think, to win an election on.
Let's go to Alex in Boston. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
We're well. What do you see, Alex?
Actually, I'm calling regarding the American policy in Middle East.
Okay.
If the President Bush policy wants to be successful, I think they should change the whole policy toward people in Middle East and also even the government. I think if
in what direction, Alex?
I think if they get together with Persian and not to listen to Israelis, they're going to be very successful. They're going to be get lots of economic success, like the China had won like $120 billion with Iranian.
But we heard earlier, you know, what part of death to America don't you understand? You're saying drop Israel, pick up Tehran. Is that?
No, are you? I think that the whole thing is problem with America doesn't want to understand Iranian revolution from 1979. If you look at the past 30 years, you see that American has lost ground in Middle East. And I don't know why they don't listen to this statistic.
Alex, we got the perspective. Let me get another voice in here. Our time grows short on the same subject from Sumter, South Carolina. Harrison's on the air. Hi, Harrison. What do you think?
Hi. My view is similar to his. I think the real problem is the administration's simplistic view of foreign policy. And I think there were two opportunities for the administration to make inroads. And one was in the case with when Hamas won the election. Mm-hmm. They should have used that event as an effort to move Hamas rather than shun them as an unacceptable entity. And I think in the case with a letter from the president of Iran, they really should have responded, but with an interpretation the way they want the letter to have been, rather than just shunning the letter saying it's a joke.
Mm-hmm.
I think they should have said, take it point by point and spin it with interpretation to how the administration and how America want the administration, want the Middle East to be, and start the dialogue and make an effort to continue it going. And the fact that he went on television, I think, shows that he still wants to talk.
Harrison, we've got it, and thank you for your call from South Carolina. Bill McKenzie, listeners, you know, keep pointing to that big situation in the Middle East, and here we have two saying, USA, you've got to have some kind of fundamental reorientation right in your thinking here.
Well, the administration is not going to drop Israel and go pick up Iran. We know that, and nor should they. Israel is our ally in the region, has been, and we should keep our ties close there. However, we can also do what Bush's father did, and that is to be more of a broker in the region for our own good and for Israel's own good, because the situation, the numbers aren't changing. And so if somebody, i.e. the administration, go in and have a broader strategy over the next 2 years that's trying to accommodate some of these elements we're talking about in negotiation, as well as support for Israel, everybody's going to have to be involved in this. It isn't going to be drop Israel and go get Iran.
Trudy, can we do that? Can we go back to the broker role, or have things, I don't know, is the country locked into the clash of civilizations narrative now?
I think when we went into Iraq, we got it backwards. We thought Iraq was going to be a trigger for regime change, internal overthrow in Tehran, in Syria. And the real truth was you couldn't deal with Iraq unless you had a regional strategy. It's not just a case of being a broker. You had to look at how it was really going to impact the region and whose help you needed. We did need Iran's help because the people we were supporting in Iraq were allies of Iran. And we never have faced that. We haven't faced it till today. The problem now is it's much harder to do what we should have done then, which is to have some kind of a dialogue with Iran, not a capitulation, but we have common interests. and trying to see if we could get through to them what our red lines were, what we would give, and what we needed from them. I think we still need to do that, and we need to abandon the idea of bombing Tehran, which would be totally counterproductive and wouldn't lead to regime change. But it's much harder now because Iran is feeling so much more confident because we look so weak.
Jack, our time is short. Bill, yeah?
I'll just say, before we write all this off as impossible, just don't forget the administration was talking with Tehran after 9/11 and as it regards Afghanistan.
Could happen again.
But they refused to do it with Iraq. Now they are half-hearted about it. They've got to make up their minds.
Yeah, and way out there in the stars, Jack, Pluto, maybe no longer a planet, but a Pluton. How's our horoscope look, Jack, our national horoscope?
We've been downgraded.
Uh-oh.
A multiplicity of planets in the future.
Oh, boy. We've got to be a celestial body somehow. I want to thank each of you for being with us. Trudy Rubin at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Trudy, wonderful having you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Bill McKenzie, editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Bill, thanks for being here.
Thank you all.
And Jack, good to have you. Thanks, my friend. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.